Very pleasant good evening to all of you tonight, and I hope you've had a good day, whatever you've engaged yourself in, whether business or pleasure or whatever the case may be. It's a wonderful day. 72 degrees, bright blue sky, low humidity. I love Houston, Texas, because it's like this every day, right? But every once in a while, you get one of these Chamber of Commerce kind of days, and that's what today was. And wow, it was a pleasure to be a part of it. And I'm glad to end it with you tonight as we have sung together and pray together and praise our God together and trust that He'll be pleased with our efforts tonight. We're glad you're a part of our service. I was able to have lunch today with some friends over in College Station. Enjoyed visiting with them. Don was with me today, so we just enjoyed our time together. And then good friend Tony and Sherry Mock are with us tonight, and count them as very, very dear and close friends, and appreciate them and their work so very, very much. And we share a lot of good memories, and I just love them dearly. Open your Bibles tonight to 2 Corinthians 7. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. Paul writes and he says, "Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." Now, that last phrase, I want you to mark that. I want you to highlight that either in your Bible or in your mind. I want you to remember that because we're going to come back to that. Perfecting holiness in the fear of, or out of reverence for, or out of respect for God. We'll call his name Greg. Greg walked to his car, hit the button on the keypad, and nothing worked. He hit it again, and the door locks did not work. He was able to take his key, and he was able to manually get in the car, you know, the old-fashioned way. But when he got in the car, it wouldn't start. And he looked, and his gas gauge was on empty, although he had just filled it up an hour before. And he began to notice that nothing in the vehicle was working. And so they had to tow the car to the dealership. And the mechanic came back after putting it on the computer and giving the diagnosis. The mechanic came back and said, "Greg, you've got a bad BCM. It stands for the basic control module of the vehicle. And if the basic control module, which is kind of the brain of your car, if it goes bad, nothing in your car is going to work." Now, Greg could have insisted, "No, I want you to fix my door locks. I want you to fix my remote control. I want you to fix my gas gauge. I want you to fix all of these individual things that are not working." But Greg was smart enough to know that all of those individual things were merely symptoms of a much bigger problem. I wonder sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to marriage, I wonder sometimes how often we just focus on all the individual symptoms instead of the basic control module. Here's a couple, and they sit down and they say, "Well, you know, we need to improve communication." Okay, but that's a symptom. "Or we need to get better at handling conflict." Okay, but that's a symptom. "Or we need to show more appreciation and affection one for the other." Okay, but that's a symptom. And we can spend a lot of our time working on the symptoms, when maybe what we need to do is focus on the basic control module. And the basic control module for Christians is a spiritual focus and a spiritual motivation. It's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1 when he says, we are to perfect holiness in the fear of God. Now, I don't know what you think that means, but I'll tell you what I think that means. I think that means you put God first in everything. So I ask the question tonight. Would marriage be exempt from that? Or would marriage be included in that? See, it all comes down to this. Either you are a God-centered spouse, or you are a spouse-centered spouse. A spouse-centered spouse will act nice toward her husband as long as he acts nice toward her. A spouse-centered spouse will go out of his way for his wife as long as she remains agreeable and affectionate. But have you ever thought maybe God demands more from us than that? Paul says, here it is. You are to perfect holiness in the fear of God. The number one motivating factor in everything we do, including this very special lifelong earthly relationship, the motivating factor in our lives needs to be reverence and respect for God. I'm not called to love my wife because she's holier than anybody else. I'm not called by God to love my wife because she always makes me happy. I am not called to love my wife because things between us every day are always so wonderfully ooey and gooey. I'm not called to love my wife for those reasons. I'm called to love my wife out of reverence for God, period. And that's what Paul says. Perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Every decision I make, every attitude I manifest has to come from this one holy motivation. Is this something that pleases God? So let me ask you a question about your relationship, your marriage. Are you just treating symptoms? Or have you gone back and looked at the basic control module? So let me take a few moments of your time tonight and talk about sacred marriage and what it is that makes it sacred. We're talking about in our theme this week, trusting God in times like these. Well, let me tell you something. That starts at home. And I think sometimes we forget that. You know, there's all kinds of quotes out there about marriage. But I'm going to tell you my all-time favorite. My all-time favorite is from that Greek philosopher, Socrates. Remember Socrates? Here it is. Socrates said, by all means, get married. If you get a good wife, you will be happy. If you get a bad wife, you will become a philosopher. There you go. Now you know a little bit about Socrates. Why didn't God design this marriage thing to be easier than it is? I mean, it sounds easy. When you're on the outside looking in, it looks easy. My wife was going through the receiving line at a wedding not long ago. And the bride standing there, and it was her turn. So Julie stepped up and gave the bride a big hug. And oh, the bride looked at my wife and she said, oh, I'm just so glad the hard part's over. Well, guess what my wife said? She said, oh, honey, the hard part hadn't even started yet. I don't know what she meant by that. You ever watch any of these romantic comedies on television? These Hallmark movies? I hate to tell you, they're all the same, every single one of them. They're all identical. Here is a beautiful couple, and they fall in love in improbable circumstances, and then they fall out of love, and then they fall back in love in the final 30 minutes of the show, and then the end. That's it. And every one of those movies, they're exactly the same. And it makes it look so easy. But it's not easy. And the reason it's not easy is because romantic love doesn't have a whole lot of elasticity. Romantic love cannot be stretched very far, because you begin to stretch romantic love and you stretch it very far and it just breaks and it shatters. Because romantic love tends to be all about me. On the other hand, mature love, holy love, starts stretching. And it stretches farther than anybody thinks that it can. It has to. Because when two selfish, sinful people start living together as one, there's going to be trouble. Unless each embrace a higher motivation. And that higher motivation is respect and reverence for God. You ever think maybe God has a higher purpose for this thing called matrimony than two people sharing the same mailbox and sharing the same kitchen table and sharing the same bedroom? That maybe God has a higher motivation than that? That maybe it's not your happiness He has in mind as much as it is your holiness. Now, I'm not saying those two are mutually exclusive. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying when you look at your relationship through the lens of God's purpose, you start having a whole new perspective. And it's like the light bulb goes on and it says, you know, this marriage thing is not all about me. So what's the purpose behind this very intense, lifelong relationship? What is the real purpose behind all of this? I don't think it is what a lot of people think it is. I think the real purpose behind this intense, lifelong relationship is to draw me closer to the one who brought us together. Because I'll just tell you something. My relationship with God is going to outlast my relationship with my spouse. Here is my relationship with my spouse. Here is my relationship with my God. And that's why just working on a few symptoms all along isn't going to work in the long run. Now, you can try to make your home more pleasant, peaceful, and you should. You can try to look for ways to keep the romance alive, and you should do that too. And you should show respect and courtesy and kindness and politeness, and you should do all of those things. But if your relationship with God is not what it ought to be, then all you're doing is treating a few symptoms. And God wants something more from us than that. The problem is sometimes we look for something in another human being that ultimately and eternally only God can provide. And I think that's why marriage dissatisfaction sometimes runs so high, because we expect too much. It's like trying to run today's computer programs on an old 486 computer. My first computer was a 486. Anybody else want to say that theirs was too? Anybody? 486? Remember those? Huh? Older? How old are you? I was in the Smithsonian a couple years ago, and looking around in the Museum of History, and there was a 486 computer. Now, you know you're getting old when your stuff is in the Smithsonian. Okay, it's not that the old 486 computer was bad. It was the cutting edge of technology in its day. It wasn't that the computer was bad. It's just that if you tried to run today's programs on that old computer, it's not going to work, because you're going to ask it to do more than is possible for it to do. And maybe sometimes we ask too much of our marriage. In other words, if you're seeking the largest percentage of your life fulfillment from your spouse, then you're asking too much. Because you were created with an eternity in mind, craving an eternal relationship with God. And your wife isn't God, and your husband isn't God. Only God can fill that ache in your soul. And when you finally get that, when you finally understand that, then and only then will you have a new appreciation for the person with whom you have embarked on this very special but brief earthly journey. Now then, it is amazing to me as you go through the Bible how often Scripture connects God's special relationship with His people to marriage. In Isaiah chapter 62 and verse 5, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so God rejoices over you. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 15, Jesus refers to Himself as the bridegroom. Matthew chapter 22, He compares the kingdom of heaven to a wedding feast. Revelation 19 and verse 7, the wedding of the Lamb, He says the bride has made herself ready. Back in the Old Testament, the breakdown of spiritual fidelity of Israel is often depicted in terms of marital infidelity. Jeremiah 3 and verse 8, God says, listen carefully, I gave Israel her divorce and I sent her away because of her adulteries. But perhaps no place is the sacredness of marriage seen any more with any greater clarity than in Ephesians chapter 5. Where holy matrimony is shown to be holy because it is compared to the holy union between Christ and His church. In Ephesians 5 and verse 25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her. Verse 29, no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ also does the church. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you is to love his own wife even as himself. And the wife must see to it that she respect her husband. How can you read that and not come away with a higher appreciation for the sacredness of marriage? How can you read passages like that and not understand why it is called holy matrimony? In 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9, he says, Therefore we also have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to what? To be pleasing to Him. He said our life ambition, our life goal, is to be pleasing to God. Ladies and gentlemen, the first purpose of marriage that gets us beyond the bearing of children, that gets us beyond sexual expression, that gets us even beyond companionship. The first purpose of marriage is the first purpose of everything else. It's to conduct our lives in such a way as to be pleasing to God. I think about that when somebody sits down and they start complaining. And they'll say things like, well, you know, Frank just doesn't make me happy. And I want to just go, Fox News alert. You know, it's not about your happiness. That's not what this is designed for. It's about God's happiness. Verse 9. Whether we are at home or absent, what is our life goal? To be pleasing to Him. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 31. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. I've got to ask this question. Is marriage exempt from all of those passages? Or would marriage be included in those passages? verse 15. Stay in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 15. He died for all, so that they who live might no longer live for themselves. You mean it's not about me? No. No longer live for themselves, but for him who died and rose again on their behalf. Is marriage exempt from that? Or would marriage be included in that? You see, God is demanding something of me. He is demanding that I look at my life through the lens of his perspective. And he says, if you will look at your life, every part of it, including this, through the lens of my perspective, what you're going to learn is your marriage is not about your happiness and your glory and your honor. Your marriage is about bringing happiness and glory and honor to God. And I think sometimes we forget that. Look in verse 18. We'll just stay in 2 Corinthians 5. Verse 18. Now all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. I think Paul is talking specifically about the commission he's given to the apostles to go into all the world and preach the gospel. But I'll tell you this. Is not the very work of the gospel and not the very work of the church, the ministry of reconciliation, to take the good news of Christ and to share that good news that man can be reconciled to God through the death of Jesus on the cross? You say, well, what does that have to do with marriage? Well, I want you to think about that word. Reconcile. Reconcile. Where have you heard the word reconciled in regard to marriage? Well, I'll tell you one place you've heard it. You've heard it when two people stand up in front of the judge and they get a divorce and they give the reason for the divorce as irreconcilable differences. And so reconciled becomes irreconciled. So what's the point? The point is if our homes become fraught with fighting and distrust and anger and animosity and resentment, then guess what? Our marriage contradicts our message. Because what is our message? Our message is one of reconciliation. And if my marriage contradicts my message, then I have sabotaged the very goal of my life. And what is the goal of my life? Verse 9, to live to be pleasing to Him. And by living to be pleasing to Him, then sharing the message of reconciliation with others. Do you not understand that a marriage that is God-honoring literally puts flesh on a picture of reconciliation? A marriage that is God-honoring models selflessness and sacrifice and forgiveness. And what do you think is the basis of reconciliation if it is not sacrifice and selflessness and forgiveness? What I'm saying to you tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is that what we do in a marriage relationship on a regular basis when it comes to forgiveness and sacrifice and selflessness is what God does for us and what God keeps on doing for us. Your marriage will either be a stumbling block or a stepping stone to the gospel message of reconciliation. How can I tell my kids that God's promises are sound and secure if they see that my promises don't mean one thing? Now, there's an exception. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, Romans 12 and verse 18, Paul said, as far as it depends upon you, be at peace with all men. Sometimes you learn a very hard lesson. And that is when it comes to life, the only person you can control is yourself. And so if you have a spouse who is bound and determined to be morally unfaithful, there's not anything you can do about that. Because God created all of us with the freedom of choice and the freedom to make our own decisions. And Jesus talked about that in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, where God allows unfaithfulness to break the bonds of holy matrimony and allows the innocent one to put away the other. But even then, that's not the first resort. That's not the loophole. That's not the way out. That's the last resort. Somebody said to me one time, well, I don't think there's a such thing as an innocent party. Well, you take that with the Lord. But secondly, what is usually meant by that statement is there's no such thing as a perfect party. That's true. But it's not about perfection. It never is. What it is about glorifying God in my life. What it is about is asking the one question you must ask in any situation you're in. And that is the situation, and that is the question, what would God want me to do? And that's the question you have to ask and answer. And what God would want you to do is to do your best at reconciliation. Now, sometimes that's not possible. But here's my point tonight. In a society in which we live, and we see it all of the time, in which relationships are just discarded with frightening regularity, and where couples get married and then it's not very long till one or the other fail to keep their promises, and sometimes spouse bashing becomes a national pastime, Christians who work hard at maintaining a God-glorifying relationship, those people are going to command attention. Because our lives and our relationships and our marriages become platforms for evangelism that will either lead others to Him or push them away. Let me ask you a question tonight. How many of you have celebrated a 25th wedding anniversary? Raise your hand. 30. 30. 40. 50. 60. 100. I was somewhere and this guy just kept raising his hand. 60. I said 70. He raised. I said 100. He raised his hand. I said, you've been married 100 years? He said, well, it certainly feels like it. I would not want to be in your car on the way home. You know, we see people who have been married these many years, and those of us who are younger or maybe haven't been married as long look at this and we say, well, you know, they must have had it easier than we have it. Well, that's not true. When you see hands raised like that, I'll tell you what that is. That is a living testimony to the power of God's love and God's forgiveness and God's reconciliation. Because, ladies and gentlemen, that is the basis of the gospel message itself. And I know this lesson on marriage is not your typical lesson, but I think sometimes we just don't think about it this way. And I'll leave you with one more thought. And I don't think we think about this either. When you got married, and you married a Christian, you married a child of God. You married God's daughter. You married God's son. You married God's child. Now, if you want to get on the good side of a parent, you understand. You be good to his kids. On the other hand, if you want to make a parent very angry, then you start picking on his kids. Or you're mean, or you be the bully. And suddenly you fire up righteous indignation pretty quick. Well, it's the same with God. Zechariah 2 and verse 8 says, he who touches you touches the apple of his eye. You married God's child. So then, when it comes to my relationship, it's not just about me and this other person over here. It's about me and my attitude toward God's daughter. Now, we spend time talking about sometimes this analogy that God is our Father up in heaven. And Jesus taught us to pray. When you pray, pray, our Father who art in heaven. Well, extend the analogy. If God is the father of the woman you married, Guess what that makes him? He's your father-in-law. Because you married his child. And guys, if you fail to respect your wife, and you demean her, and you mistreat her, or speak condescendingly to her, I'm going to tell you what Peter says in 1 Peter 3 or 7. You're going to court trouble with your father-in-law. He calls us out in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. He says, you husbands, that would be me and many of you. He calls us out. He says, you husbands, live with your wife in an understanding way. And he says, grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life. Why should I do that? So that your prayers be not hindered. I think most of us fail to grasp how passionate God is toward the person we marry. He designed your spouse as a one-of-a-kind person. He sent his son to die for your spouse. And that makes your spouse very, very special in the eyes of God. You know, as a human father of four, I pray that my kids will all marry someone who will love them as much as I do. But I will tell you about all four of our children, they all four fall short of perfection. They all have their quirks and they all have their limitations and they've all made their mistakes. And so it is my prayer that they will have a spouse who will be kind to them. That they will marry people who, someone who is forgiving of them and patient with them. I would cringe to think that they would marry someone who would be cruel to them or abusive to them or hurt them in some way. Now, God is fully aware that the person to whom you are married has limitations, has faults, has made mistakes. He wants you to be as forgiving and patient with their faults as we would want our kids' spouses to be with them. Think about that. Think about how you treated your spouse this past week. And think about, is that how you would want your son treated by his spouse? Is that how you would want your daughter treated by her spouse? And that ring that you wear on your left hand, do you understand what that represents? It should be an ever-present reminder that you didn't just marry any man, you didn't just marry any woman. You married a child of God. And he's watching every day to see how you treat his precious child. We talk about trusting God in times like these. That starts at home. That starts in the way that we treat one another in our marriages. Some of you have met my wife. Well, she was here last time I was here. Some of you heard her speak down in Columbus not too long ago. And so I don't want you to tell her what I'm fixing to tell on her, because I'm not going to throw her under the bus, although it sounds like I'm going to throw her under the bus. She's a great cook. Julie's a great cook, and she loves to cook. And I don't remember what the occasion was. But she wanted to cook a big meal for Luke and myself, and we'd gone out and done something that day, and we were coming home, and she said, "When you boys get home," she said, "I'm just gonna have a great meal ready for you, and it's gonna be really good tonight." So okay, so we came home, and she cooked up this fantastic meal, and it was wonderful, and it came time for dessert. And so we cleared away the dishes, and she said, "I made you guys a chocolate pie." And I want to tell you something. It was one of those pies that looked fake. The meringue, it was just perfect. It looked perfect. And so she said, "I made you a chocolate pie, and let me cut you some pieces here, and we'll all have dessert together." And so she cut a piece of chocolate pie, and she set it down in front of me. Now, you need to understand something about my wife. She's big into manners and etiquette. And so one of the rules in our house is that when we have dessert, you don't just dig in, you wait, you sit and you wait until everybody's been served and the hostess sits down. And so I'm sitting there waiting. So she goes over to cut Luke a piece of chocolate pie. And while she's over there, I take the tip of my fork and I kind of stick it in a little of that chocolate, because that doesn't count in my book. And I stick it a little bit in that chocolate and I put it on the tip of my tongue. And I'm going to tell you something, folks. That was the worst tasting thing I believe I have ever tasted in my life. And I realized she didn't put any sugar in it. It was horrible. It was awful. Looked great, but it was horrible. And I started to open my mouth and say something. And I thought, oh no, this is too good. Just be quiet. And so I just sat there, and she cut Luke an even bigger piece and put it in front of him. And she got her piece, and she said, go ahead, dig in, boys, dig in. And I thought, this is going to be worth the price of admission. And he took his fork. He didn't just get a little bit. He got a hunk of that chocolate, put it in his mouth. And I mean, suddenly his eyes just got so big, and his cheeks bulged out. And I mean, he couldn't. It was chocolate explosion, let me just say. Well, she was beside herself. She says, what in the world is wrong? What happened? And so she took a bite. She said, oh, no, it's terrible. No, no. And she started to grab our plates. And I said, no, no, leave them here. She said, you're not going to eat this. I said, leave them here. And I looked at Luke and I winked. And we raked off the meringue. And I'm going to tell you something about my wife. She makes the best meringue pie you have ever put in your mouth. And I thought about that a lot, because I thought, you know, marriage is a lot like that. We get married and we think every day is just going to be sweet, perfect. But not every day is. And some days you just eat the meringue. But you like that too. And you learn to like that too. May God help all of us in our relationships to understand one thing, that like anything else we do, and it's not just the marital relationship, it is anything we do. This is all about pleasing God. This is all about bringing honor and glory to Him. This isn't about you and me. This is about Him. May God help me. May God help you. May God help all of us to realize what a blessed responsibility, what an awesome responsibility we have to live as Christians in every walk. Especially this one. We sing the invitation song tonight. If you're not a Christian, why don't you give your life to the one who gave his life for you? And you can be baptized tonight for the remission of your sins. Don't put that off. If you're ready, we're here to help you. And you can be baptized tonight. If you've wandered off and you're not living right, not doing right, let me tell you something. If that's between you and God, go home and get in your closet, Jesus said. Get in a private place and talk to the Lord about that. That's between you and the Lord. But if it's something that others know about, if it's something others can help you with, then you need to let it be known that you're willing and wanting to turn your life around. If we can help you in any way tonight, we invite you to come while we stand together and while we sing together.